All right. Greetings, everybody, and welcome to another installment of Innovation Crush. It's me, Chris Denson, your gracious host, coming at you once again. Today we have some really awesome guests in the house. You guys go ahead and introduce yourselves, and then I'll interject you know, with some wisdom and questionnaires.
Well, I'm Randy Barbado, and I am a co-founder of World of Wonder and co-producer, co-director of Maplethorpe.
Did you just try to take credit for all of you guys?
Fenton's here. If he wasn't here.
I'm the other half, the co-founder. I'm Fenton Bailey and do the same thing Randy does, really. We're partners at World of Wonder.
And how long has World of Wonder been a thing?
World of Wonder has been around for about 123 years.
Wow.
We've had really good work, right?
Yeah.
We've been around for 25 years. 25 years.
Since the last century.
Yes. Fenton and I started working together actually at film school at NYU, and then we started a company not long after that. And
by the way, I have to admittedly, I spent a lot of this morning listening to the fabulous Pop-Tarts.
Good for you.
I almost danced in my socks. It was weird, but it was just tell the people a little bit about the fabulous Pop-Tarts because I had a blast.
All right. Well, what was your favorite song?
One of them was your first video on MTV, that was the one I jammed out to a little bit.
See, the Pop-Tarts were around before the internet, but cruelty has somehow this stuff has ended up on the interwebs.
Yes.
It's not fair.
We can't escape the Pop-Tart.
It was part of
Don't escape it. It is part of your lineage.
Yes. It was part of our ill-conceived strategy that we would break into Hollywood making independent films by becoming pop stars and using the proceeds from our huge hits to fund our films. Because it was hard to raise money to make movies back in the day.
Right.
Before independent film really took off. And the only flaw in the strategy was that we needed some hits and we didn't have any hits and we couldn't get a record. We did get record contracts. We did get publishing contracts, but Seymour Stein, who famously signed Madonna, and tell me when this is too much information, but Seymour Stein,
it's never too much information, by the way,
famously signed Madonna on his deathbed, was called up by our manager and he said, "Haven't you heard of the Pet Shop Boys?" and hung up the phone because we were considered to be not dissimilar to Pet Shop Boys. Although I would say we were significantly camper than the Pet Shop Boys.
I felt a little culture possible. Club. That's kind of like where I immediately went to.
Yeah.
But we were really pretty, I wouldn't say bad, but mediocre. And however, the great thing about the Pop-Tarts was we did get a bunch of deals and we saved all that money. And that's how we started World of Wonder. And the other weird thing about the Pop-Tarts is almost 20 years later, after the Pop-Tarts never had a hit or something like that, RuPaul called us up and he said, "Oh my God, I just heard a Pop-Tart song on the Don't Mess with Zohan film soundtrack.
Yeah.
And we're like, no. And he's like, "No, you need to check it out. New York City Beat's on there." And sure enough, we checked it out and it was there. And Armin Van Helden had taken a Pop-Tart song and remixed it, but he kept our vocals, kept the whole song. So without our permission. So we
lawsuit.
Hello. So we both got new cars because it ended up being like kind of it was like a little hit in Europe, and
it was a big hit in Europe.
The updated version was a hit. Then that's okay.
Armin Van Helden's version was a big hit in Europe, and it was in this movie, this massive movie. You know, only Star Wars is bigger than the Zohan movie. As you know.
So, cha-ching.
Yeah, no, that's a great story of pivoting. I mean, we talked to a lot of entrepreneurs. No, seriously, like, right, you had a game plan. We had Damien Kulash on from OK Go, and their early days, I mean, they make amazing music videos, but they started in creativity because, one of them went to RISD or something like that and figured, like, we can make flyers. If we can make amazing flyers, the venues will book us. And, you know, that was 1998 or something like that. So similar journey. You guys are you're on your way to success.
Yeah, and totally. And everything, and we are on our way. I mean, it all takes it takes a little bit of time, but no, everything we've ever done has been very DIY. And, you know, our whole career started with many massive failures. And to this day, in our swank offices on Hollywood Boulevard, in our conference room, we have this big painting. It's a paint by number painting, and it has the word yes, because our whole philosophy is no is the beginning of yes, because we've never really sold anything. We've never sold anything in the room. We've never
really.
Yes. Well, we did once. And then the next day the executive called up and said, I've changed my mind.
Yes. So,
and just to put that in perspective, cause I have some numbers. Oh. We have a gigantic research team here.
Uh-huh, I see them all.
Yeah, you're literally looking at them. 220 original series, 41 networks, 1,600 episodes of television. Am I in the right ballpark?
That's right. Yeah.
And, you know, an amazing documentary on HBO currently, which I think was a return home for you guys in a sense, right? Like, wasn't the first documentary that you guys did?
It's about the 20th.
Well, I mean, as far as was, like...
Yes, that's where we started our filmmaking careers at HBO.
So it's interesting though, like with a track record like that, you don't sell in the room. Is that just because it's not a common practice that, you know, the studios or networks will go like, yes, we want it, let's do it now.
Right. You hear all these stories about selling it in the room.
Yeah, exactly.
To me, it's like the unicorn.
Napkin deals. Like that's what I'm still waiting for. Napkin deal.
Uh-huh. It's like the unicorn, often, you know, quoted and talked about, but rarely seen in our case anyway. I mean, yeah.
Yeah. People always have a good time with us in the room. People always want us to come back. They still call us the boys. They think that we're like club kids. Still, we're bald, but they still think we're club kids. But they
we're
never
all bald,
really.
Well,
I thought yours is a choice, though.
It's slightly by choice. It's by design, and like I'm in the smart. In between phase.
You're ahead of the curve,
literally.
But yeah, we don't sell in the room.
So, I mean, but with this experience, right, and with the number of projects you've been able to accomplish, which we can probably get into in a second, what have you discovered about the art of the pitch? Whether it is that expectation to go back, like what are the successful check marks of pitching?
I think it's the Linda Obst quote that always sticks with me, which is ride the horse in the direction it's going. So you kind of want to pick up on what's happening in the room and go with that. One series we sold was about Andy Warhol. We did this big 6-part series for British television called Andy Warhol, The Complete Picture. And it wasn't on our list of things to pitch when we went into the room, but the art of reading upside down, of reading what's on someone's desk in a meeting, that's a useful ability. And we happened to see that she'd written the words Andy Warhol on a piece of paper on her desk. So everything was not going well. None of the ideas were finding a home. But suddenly we just said, oh, you know, we've always wanted to make a series about Andy Warhol. And she lit up like a Christmas tree. And so go with the
Did you actually have an Andy Warhol picture or pitch in your back pocket? Or?
No, not at that precise moment.
Right.
But we knew enough about Andy Warhol to talk it through and say this would be the time to tell a story. And you know,
Fenton has a huge back pocket. Seriously.
Nice.
I'll show it to you later.
But I, the other thing I think, yes, reading upside down really helps. I do genuinely think though, like having a good time, like we pitch and we do have ideas and we have great people who work with us who are much better at pitching than Fenton and I are, but we always have a good time in the pitch meeting. So people love to hear our pitches and then people know that we do good work. So if the pitch doesn't sell, that's okay, because they're always going to want us to come back. And sometimes there's an idea. Mapplethorpe is a great example where Sheila Nevins at HBO in a meeting was like, you know, what about Mapplethorpe? She said to us, so she sort of put that out in the air, and she knows that we know how to make great stuff. And she knew that the combination of us and Mapplethorpe could make something pretty fabulous. And so I think it's less about sometimes just, you know, being, having a good time with people, connecting with people, and then also being open to other people's ideas or other people's right. suggestions. Because if you have a relationship over, like with Sheila, is like 100 years that we've worked with her.
She's only 20.
Yes, that's true. You know,
she's been around for a long time, 100 years, 123 years. This is
it's like Vampire Lestat.
What We Do in the Shadows is another great.
Oh, it's fantastic.
Crazy.
Taika's film.
When you say having a good time outside of showing people your back pockets, mm-hmm. What does that consist of? Because I think I understand in terms of like building rapport, like, you know, what are some of those mechanics?
Like, in a very specific way, we went out with Fantasia to pitch a show and we ordered, we brought in barbecue chicken. We turn it into a party. Like we turn our pitches into party. That was an example of selling a show, but Fantasia sold that show. We didn't, you know.
I was thinking of the Gold Digger show that we took out with Gene Simmons from Kiss, who's a fantastic character. I mean, and our brilliant idea there was that we'd hire a stretch limousine and we put the cast in the stretch and then got the executive, put them in the stretch and drove off with them.
Nice.
And the block.
We never sold the show. So it doesn't always work.
Right.
Right.
We had the wrong cast.
They had a good time.
But I mean, to your point though, it becomes a memorable moment for those individuals. They will call you in to do something and, you know, hopefully in most cases, but it is part of that developing a memorable moment at that point. But it's also probably, as I can tell from this conversation, very natural to how you guys are in your day to day.
I think it just has to be organic, really.
Yeah.
The pitch.
Go ahead. Disagree?
Totally. I was just going to say most of the time we're pitching things that to most people seem so out there, you know, we tend to be kind of out there, but as we get older and as the world gets older, the kind of fringe
200 years old.
Yes. Yeah. No, but the main, the
out there is now in here.
Yes. Like fringe has become mainstream,
right.
You know, it's so we're just waiting.
But also pity the executive, you know, who has to take meetings day after day, day meetings. Sometimes the last thing they want to hear is another pitch. So sometimes it's just like, let's just chat a little.
Yeah.
Right. You know?
Uh-huh.
Just catch up.
I once pitched Malcolm X in the Middle as a joke to an executive. And for a minute, it was like a pitch day at a thing. And you should have saw this guy's face. He was so like, oh my gosh, like really. And then I snapped out of it and he was like, oh, thank God. And then we got into the real pitch, which I also didn't sell. But, you know.
But I would have bought Malcolm X in the Middle.
It's not too late. It's still available. It's only 15 years ago, I think, that happened. So just so we can put this in perspective, give us an idea of the body of work you guys have created over the past 723 years.
Well, you know, we started before television was invented. So first we had to invent
radio. No, Superman.
I mean, mainly, I guess the work we do falls into kind of two categories. On the one hand, TV series, and then on the other hand, feature docs and features. And we've done scripted too. We did the movie Party Monster with Macaulay Culkin and Seth Green and Marilyn Manson, and that was based on the documentary that we also directed and produced called Party Monster, because we had a hard time thinking of different titles. And that's actually something we'd like to do more of, where you know, you do a documentary and that ends up being a sort of research process,
right.
And then you can do a scripted. And, but that's, I suppose it divides into, and we're very screen agnostic. You know, we don't think it really matters whether it's a big screen or a small screen. You know, it's not the size of the screen that matters. It's the dimensions of the story.
Ah, that's quotable.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But you had that one in the back pocket. I take it.
It's in my enormous back pocket.
Anything to add?
No, I think that was good.
So there's the RuPaul series. What else has been on the on
Drag
the
Race? Million Dollar Listings, which is on Bravo. Million Dollar Listings, LA. Million Dollar Listings, New York.
Big Frida, which is on Fuse. Ass everywhere. Ass everywhere.
Yes. Yep. Ass everywhere.
Ass everywhere. The queen of bounce.
I don't know the lyrics, but I knew the rhythm, the cadence. So that's the best I could do. So, you know, with that, is there Is there a sweet spot for you guys? I mean, it sounds like from $1 million listings to RuPaul.
For some reason, people think we're gay. So we end up doing a lot of gay stuff. I don't know how that happens. But no, I mean, it's weird. I guess when you do one thing, there is a you can get trapped in the sense that people think you can only do the thing that you've done. And we like to keep changing it because... whether it's a game show or an elimination competition show or a feature documentary or a scripted movie, it really what we really love is storytelling. And
well, how do you escape stigma in that essence, right? Because like, a lot of people do get pigeonholed, or whether you're typecast as a as an actor, or even in my career, it's like, oh, that's the such and such guy, and I was like, no, I can do more than that. Like, how did you break out of not being pigeonholed as the
I don't know if that we have, but we just keep doing what we're doing. So we just don't go away,
Yeah.
And we just keep doing different stuff and more of it. And we actually like what we do, and we like to work. And so we do a lot of it. And by the way, we also work with a lot of kind of like-minded people. I think, some people have typecast us as gay, but I think we're more queer in the non-gay way, like queer in the alt, like everyone who feels like an outsider, mm-hmm. Like
fringe culture.
Yeah. That's a lot of the stuff, a lot of the stuff we produce, a lot of the people where we've made films about, or a lot of the ideas kind of come from that. A lot of the people who work at World of Wonder kind of relate to that.
Sure.
They're all sort of, it's our tribe, and that kind of that motivates what we do and makes it, I don't know, rewarding.
And it's cool. I mean, I think when you talk about screen agnostic, and I think what technology has allowed us to do is reach fringe audiences a little bit more deeply than it used to. I mean, back when the Pop-Tarts videos were out, it was like, or you couldn't find that scene as easily as you could now. So, with that, and you're producing for the fringe culture, and you mentioned the culture you have internally at World of Wonder. Can you just talk about like what kind of culture you've established inside the company? As much as you guys are the beautiful faces and the front runners of it, like there is a machine in place of sorts.
We're different to other production companies, I think, in that there are actual artists and producers and showrunners and who are on staff at World of Wonder. So there are all these great filmmakers who are working there, and some of them will, get to do a one-off, or, I think of someone like Stephen Korff, who's one of the executive producers of RuPaul's Drag Race. He started out as our assistant, and he's English. He first became aware of World of Wonder from some of our early British work. And he now runs he runs the show. And, he was smart and fully realized when he started working at World of Wonder, and he grew into doing something where we just have to look at a cut and it makes us laugh,
Awesome. And how long has he been a part of, what's that journey from assistant to executive producer?
It's like a week.
I was going to say, started on Monday, Friday I was running the place.
We all work for him.
It's funny though, because sometimes when we do pitches on conference calls, people think that everyone at World of Wonder is like running around
I have this big circus thing
doing drugs.
Like it's fun.
Yeah, big top, So we will tease people and say, well, everybody's naked today. Today's right. Naked day at World of Wonder. But the truth is it's an office, and there are desks and phones and chairs. And it's almost very standard, I suppose, so that people can be really creative. You almost need that framework of just regularity. It's not like Andy Warhol's factory in the 60s. Let's put it that way.
Although what's a cool thing that's kind of happening at World of Wonder now, because of the rise of digital culture, we have a digital channel, Wow Presents, and we have a studio in the basement, and people are producing stuff, and people who work there have shows. And so it's kind of like you know, the ultimate dream would be to have our own network and let all our friends have their own TV shows because our friends are so entertaining, you know, Lady Bunny and Blake at World of Wonder. But and that's, you know, it feels like that's almost starting to happen with the digital network. And it's weird to see, like, the audiences that some of these people are building. You know?
Yeah, no, I spent some time at a company called Machinima. Again, you think about fringe culture and it was gamers and like a voiceless community, like pre-Machinima, right? It was like, oh, you're at home in your parents' bed. Like that was always like the stigma or the perception of what that individual is. So I think part of, you know, what you've also been able to do is shed a different light on fringe culture and tell a different story. And I think that's kind of like the underlying, if I'm being too forward or whatever, just let me know. But
how? That's like, no, but you're right. I think that it is very punk in the sense that traditional media used to be about you would have to earn your way and earn your place, whether it's the New York Times or being on a network. And now anybody can do anything. And I feel that it is such a sort of democratized environment.
Right.
And as a result, it's so exciting because all the kinds of voices and ideas that you couldn't hear before and now people are clamoring for because, like, this sounds different. This is new. This is exciting. So I think it really is an incredibly exciting time. And it's funny because Randy and I were originally really inspired by Manhattan Public Access, which were these crazy shows that people would make on their
own. That's
actually
very true, yes.
You know, it was this sort of like on a wing and a prayer, they'd make a TV show and put it on. And that was like, you can really do this? And then we collected them together and edited clips. And that was our very first show for British TV called Manhattan Cable. And people in England had never seen anything like Filthy the Dog or Mrs. Mouth or Lynn from Voyavision or Robin Bird. And it was just this crazy cavalcade of creativity that was completely unbound by the traditional rules of media, you know, that there's this idea of a canon of media that is approved and certified and you have to work really hard and prove yourself to get into. This sort of blew all that apart. And
yeah,
that was all before YouTube. It was like, that's what, you know, public access was what YouTube
viral videos.
Became, viral videos. And now we're living in that world.
Yeah.
You talked about this painting earlier, the Yes painting. Define Yes in the World of Wonder terms.
Well, the painting is by Trey Spiegel, and it's great. It's a great painting because it's a join the dots. No, not join the dots.
Paint by numbers.
Paint by numbers. And the Yes is sort of ghosts out of the French Arc de Triomphe. So what does Yes mean? I suppose Yes just doesn't mean no.
Yes.
It literally just means Yes, Chris.
Yes to me. Yes to me is a check. It's getting paid.
Yeah.
You know, Yes to me is like, Yes to me is an audience. Yes to me, you know, it's a chat. It's money.
It's outside of the money. Is it? So no, it sounds like, I mean, with the other things you listed though, it is that, the vote of appreciation, right? Like, yes, we like this, or let's go to the next level, or you have the wrong phrase in mind, but it is just an indicator that you're on the right path in a sense.
Yeah.
Yes.
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 Yeah. I see what you did there. So let's fast forward to what last month. The note I wrote was shock and awesome. When I looked at the Maplethorpe.
Like
thank you. This is what we do here.
That's going in my back pocket.
No. I'll need a check. Where did the desire to tell the Mapplethorpe story start? You know, you mentioned Sheila Nevins, but, you know, I'm sure a lot of things get said in the room. You're like, okay, cool. And but this came to fruition in a really major way.
Well, I think, you know, I do think Robert Mapplethorpe is out there somewhere guiding this. It's all very spooky because Sheila mentioned it and we started looking into it. And really, no one had really told his story since the trial, which happened after he died, and since the NEA scandal. There have been one or two things, but not really a sort of exhaustive, massive look. And it was odd only because Mapplethorpe's presence as an artist is bigger than ever. I mean, even before these exhibitions, it's like he never went away. And so the film itself came together really unusually quickly. we went to the Robert Mapplethorpe Foundation and told them what we were thinking. And they were like, yes, they said, yes, there wasn't, they didn't say no. We went to LACMA and Getty, who we'd learned were putting on these exhibitions. Yep. And we're like, oh my gosh, we got to get the film finished in time for those exhibitions. And they said, yes. And I mean, you know, and so many of his friends and people in his life, he had wanted them to write about him or tell his story. You know, like when he was dying, he told Patti Smith to made her promise to write their story. And she did in Just Kids. So his friends wanted to talk about him. So it was like, yes, yes, yes.
I think also, like, as we started digging in more and as we realized how, like, we knew of him like we knew of a brand. It was like Mapplethorpe, McDonald's. Like, Fenton and I were living in New York in the East Village. Like, we knew of him. Like, we ran parallel. We were much younger. But we ran, like, in unparalleled tracks in New York City in the 80s before he died. But we realized we heard about him all the time, but knew so little about him. And so as we dug in and as we started looking at the pictures and learning who he was, it really, I don't know. I think we personally connected with the story. It was a real ride making this film because we also had very ambivalent feelings about him. You know, he's pretty ambitious. His art is really, you know, it's beautiful, but some of it's really intense.
Yes.
And so I think there are a lot of reasons why you could say, I'm not sure if he's like someone I would really want to hang out with. And we've never made a film about anyone. Like, we made a film about Tammy Faye, Monica Lewinsky, lots of people, Chaz Bono. We've never had any mixed feelings at the beginning of that process. We kind of knew we were making this film because we had an affinity for something about them. But with Mapplethorpe, it wasn't that clear. And so we really went on a journey. And in the end, we really came to admire him.
I was going to say, do you think that sort of middle of the road kind of opinion or positioning maybe made you be a little bit more agnostic, about it? Because I think if it's somebody I admire, right, I think the tendency might be like, oh, this is going to be awesome. And like, you go into it this wholeheartedly, but then you already, like, a good documentary, I feel like, tells two sides, right? Like, you almost feel like, I want to kind of solve it on my own or to kind of figure it out on my own. Or what can I do? And you went into it with, like, forced to kind of look at both sides, like forcing, yes, convincing one side to lean toward the other and vice versa.
Yeah, I do think, especially for a film about him, like, it all of that contributed to making it kind of special, like making the film better. And definitely there are a lot of people who see this film who come out like it, you know, confused about their feelings towards him.
But it was intense. It was an intense story. It was the imagery was intense. And part of me felt like, and you guys probably know better than I do, but it felt like a lot of his work was deliberate in that sense. If you think about the time of, you know, LGBT culture and how the government and society looked at it. And it was like, you know what? Fuck you guys. Look at this. Right. Even when his brother goes, he said, when he showed me this one in the Black Book, right, he says, you think dad's going to like this one? You know, and it was like probably one of the most stark images in there. Do you feel that was kind of like, you know, an underlying goal of some of his work was to kind of really just put the culture in people's faces?
Yeah. And I think he wanted to,
literally,
to shock. Yes. I think he wanted to shock, to use shock as a way to get people to open their eyes and open their minds and open their hearts. So, like, a way to make people look at the pictures, actually, you know? But I think it wasn't like gratuitous, because I think after you've seen about 100 or 1,000 of his pictures, you begin to realize that it's not necessarily, as he said, it's not what they're of. It's not the penis. It's not the dildo. It's not.
Or the pinky in the penis.
Or the pinky in the penis. It's the composition, you know. I know. That's the one. That is the one.
That is the one. It was that one, and it was the guy with the enema straw out of it.
Oh, yeah. Joe.
That one. Yeah. Joe. Let's call him. Yes, Joe. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. No.
I mean, but that, I think it was a device to get people to pay attention.
No, definitely. And I mean, you touched on something really interesting, which you don't hear too often, is that he wanted the story to be told.
Yeah, I think an artist has a responsibility to their audience. I mean, what artist really creates work only for them? You know, an artist is creating stuff for other people to look at, enjoy, admire, feedback on.
Right.
So your responsibility as an artist is to your audience, to secure your audience, find your audience, reach your audience, engage your audience. And he took that very seriously. That was as much a part of the work as shooting the pictures was. And I think people sometimes like criticize that and say, oh, he was ambitious and he was a hustler. But really, it's a part of what the artist's job is. And to pretend otherwise is just hypocritical.
Right.
You know, artists pretend they don't want to be famous. I'm sorry. They're lying. It's a lie.
It's probably one of the biggest ego like communities ever. Like, I mean, I've spent time at Art Basel, and I'm like, wow. Like, it is, like, you can feel ego like in Miami during that time.
Yeah.
And
it's right. That's what an artist should, you know, an artist should be connected to their audience and have an audience. That's the whole point of it, right?
When did he? You know, and when does it, maybe any artist, but as specifically for Mapplethorpe, like when did he realize like what he had was special?
The beginning, before he'd made anything. Like as a kid, he's like, I want to be an artist. And he says, I didn't even know what that meant. But it's like, he knew he was special before he'd even created anything.
And one of the notes I had too is that, I mean, a lot of the storytelling talks about him not like, you know, not so much a participant and a voyeur as much as an observer, right? Like one of the guys described their, you know, intimate encounters as vanilla, right? But when you think about that, right, it's because I think about the Showtime documentary with Michael Jackson, and you see him at Studio 54, and he's just really looking at the room, right? He's just he's not dancing, he's not drinking, he's just kind of like really observing the culture, and then he tells it through his music and his energy and his creative output.
Yeah, I think that Mapplethorpe was a little more immersive than Michael Jackson in that, like, I feel like he really, I mean, he often did, you know, go into the mine shaft and walk out with a trick and you know, fool around with the trick and then take a photo.
Right.
So he basically called himself a documentarian. He talked about how, you know, documenting his life was as important as the work itself. His life was the work of art. And he was a curious guy who sort of like went on this journey that included, you know, S&M and then his obsession with black men. And he experienced it in real ways and photographed it in real ways.
Got it.
That's kind of, I mean, that's partially for me, part of what makes it so intense because, you know, and you know, in some cases he didn't, it's not like he slept with all of the people he photographed, but
most,
I'm not sure.
A lot.
Okay. But not in all cases, because then he became known as the guy.
Oh, well, he, not the, you know, celebrity he was, portraits,
he, not
right?
the celebrity portraits. And also he became known as the guy, you know, he would get a phone call, you know, I'm the guy who likes to, you know, eat poo or something like that. And
but like most of us have some sort of duality, right? You know, he's also the guy mm-hmm. who's taking pictures of flowers, right?
Yes.
And there's a softer side mm-hmm. to his work. And did you guys explore that much or what did you learn from his softer side?
A little bit. Like, I mean, the film does give more space to the explicit photos because he said himself that they were the most important pictures he took. And I think they have then a sort of shadow effect on the flowers. Suddenly you're looking at a flower, knowing that the guy who took a fisting picture, you know, there's a pistol and a stamen and there's a fist up someone's ass. And right. they have a sort of resonance, you know.
Yeah.
Together. It's like quantum thing. So you're not necessarily looking at... So the flowers, yeah.
I think the flowers are a really important part of his portfolio and partially in juxtaposition because there's the obvious sexuality thing, but also because he was obsessed with beauty. Mm. And so for him, some of the sex acts that he photographed, many of them, it would be hard for anyone to think that they're beautiful, but they are all kind of beautiful in that he wanted them perfect. You know, the composition's perfect. He turned these things into beautiful pieces of art. And I think the flowers, the statues, the portraits, I think there's a continuity with the way he treated all of his subjects.
I was gonna say he wanted to draw a parallel to say that this too is beautiful, as yes. beautiful as a flower.
Yes.
Right.
And what are flowers other than the sex organs of plants?
There's a very smart guy I know who says.
It's true.
What does that look like?
No, but I guess my point is like in addition to the fact that the flowers couldn't have existed without the explicit work, it goes both ways. Yeah. It's like you needed all of this to help legitimize, you know, you needed all the flowers and the statues to help legitimize the explicit stuff. It's the totality of the work.
Right.
And in our film, we do focus more on the explicit because of how he speaks about it. But we certainly have a lot of the flowers. We have a lot of the other work because you do have to, we have almost 500 photos in the film.
Well, you have to show that duality. Otherwise, like kind of to your point is like, you're saying like, oh, this is the pornographic, you know, artist, mm-hmm. right. Or photographer. You wouldn't even say artist in that context. If you did not see like, oh wow, he's genuinely talented outside of my, you know, realm of reference, if you will. Mm-hmm. And also think there's like, I mean, even the people that he shot, I think there's, you know, I always feel like fashion is like one of the most individualistic forms of expression. Like if you buy a car, like, you know, a ton of other people have the same car. If you buy your iPhone, a ton of other people, but the way you can put an outfit together is, you know, you can own that and it's accessible. Right. And I think even when you look at the variety of sex acts that are out there, and it is some kind of individual expression. Mm-hmm. And I've watched a lot of documentaries on sex stuff, but, but no, there, I mean, you see this, this idea that you hear about the act, right. And then you see the individual, and the two almost in most cases don't match up. Right. Mm. It's like, oh, that's a regular guy or that's a regular woman. Like, why would they do that sort of thing? And so there's this individual expression that becomes okay mm-hmm. through the lens of a Mapplethorpe.
Mm-hmm.
Boom, drop the mic.
Yes, got it.
So, I mean, with that, like, how did you guys come to, I guess, an agreement internally? I mean, emotionally internally, as far as, you know, doing away with your position of like, oh, do I feel comfortable going this route or do I not feel comfortable? What was the outcome after the project said and done? And like, now, how do you feel about having done the project?
I feel like he's a pretty brilliant artist, and I think it's the sort of the brutal honesty in terms of how he led his life and how he made his art that is his genius. And so it's the very things that made me sort of gave me pause are the very things that I think make him genius.
It's great.
Agree.
You could
cop out. No,
you could have said it better, but we would be here we would be here all day.
The documentary filmmaking process, right? And we won't go too lengthy here, but I think you set out to tell a particular story, And along the way, you start to discover other things. And I think, you know, when you parallel that to any sort of creative person's journey or business person's journey, you're like, oh, I'm going to do this. And then like the world starts to open up. You're like, oh, well, maybe we should do X. Like, how do you filter, you know, toward that end project? Does it all happen to shoot everything and then cut it together? Like, what is that process like?
Well, you know, we started out and we had a treatment. And I remember it was called Portrait of the Artist as ... because we couldn't quite figure out what came after the ... And we thought it was like, was he a nice person? Was he not a nice person? Was he an angel or a devil? And yet, I suppose in a way, on the journey, we found that he kind of transcended that. And he himself was fascinated with any kind of duality, you know, not just light and dark, good and evil, life and death. He was fascinated with all that. But as an artist, he was also this collaborator, you know, singular artist, Robert Mapplethorpe, but he collaborated with so many people, you know, Edward Mapplethorpe, his brother, or Bob Colicello, who was the editor of Interview, or his models. I mean, he said his work was this kind of collaboration. And this fascination with duality was really interesting to us because he would have one exhibition uptown of the celebrity portraits and then he'd have the sex pictures downtown. He never put them together until he knew he was dying and he planned this final show, The Perfect Moment, where he put it all together. He put the sex pictures, the black pictures, the flowers together in one case. And he was sort of building a time bomb. He knew what he was doing by putting these things that had been separate together. He knew he was going to cause a big fuss. And it happened after he died. But where am I going with this?
No, I think
the question was about process.
Yes, but the process was
you start to discover all these things along the way. It's funny because it kind of just parallels with the path of his journey, you know. Mm-hmm. But
what that translates into is just a lot of time because you just end up spending a lot more time making it than you had planned because it's like, oh, wait, you know, things are changing and you're just shooting more and more stuff and reading more and more stuff. And so even though there are aspects of this film where it came together quite quickly towards the beginning, the actual making of it took another like almost 2 years because the this process and journey of discovery, even before we shot, while we were shooting and editing, just right. took longer than you really want to ever spend.
Who are you responsible to? Because when you have a lot of stakeholders, right? You have the family, you have the friends, you have the community, if you will. You have filmmaking, you have yourselves. Like at the end of the day, like who do you go? Like okay, this is
ourselves. Yourself. You had to put all that out of your mind and just focus on telling the story the way you think it should be told and the way you think the story is telling you to tell it. You know, you have to ignore all the community issues and the this and that. And then not everyone, I mean, by and large, people are thrilled with the film, but not everybody loves it. And that's inevitable. I mean, it's an imperfect work, you know, because only if he had made it himself. Right.
But it's almost perfect. And I think that's a really good question, by the way, because this film more than there are many, many questions that have been brilliant. But that one's really good because this question really, there were so many considerations. I mean, there was like on the surface, there were so many considerations. There was the community. There was like it was a really challenging film and we just had to edit out all of that noise. Like more than I think any project we've ever worked on, because I think otherwise we would have been like, we paralyzed by fear of offending this one or that one or this organization or, you know, HBO. And that, I think that's why the film is so good in a way. And that's why when we delivered the cut, it was like,
no notes.
Kind of.
We thought there'd be like, let's lose a few penises.
Right.
But no.
Keep the penis.
Keep the penis.
We put a few extra in just in case.
Nice. It just penis extras. Was there like a line of credits? So as we wind down, how are you guys doing on time?
I gotta get out of here. HBO to go, right? HBO go and no.
You just get up and walk out. The show's called Innovation Crush, right? We're talking about everything from YouTube and what was YouTube before there was YouTube to your process to, you know, I also wanted to ask you guys a little bit about your business journey, but, can I do it? Do you have time? That's what I want to know. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
All right. You got me with the joke.
Unfortunately, Randy's driving, so I'm his passenger. So if he leaves.
Nice. Show business. You've been doing it for a very long time. You've done a great job at the show and obviously with the business. What were some of the, you know, the biggest hurdles for you guys as business people and business owners, you know, throughout this journey, right? Whether it's pivoting or finding new areas of storytelling or just how do we fund ourselves in between projects and things like that?
You know, maybe it's like so many people, you get the impression they have a plan. And we've had plans, but they never seem to work out the way you think they're going to. So it feels often as if what happens is accidental, I suppose.
Or serendipitous.
Serendipitous. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. Not paranoia, but pronoia. The universe is working to help you. And I do think that, when we started the business, we needed an office. So we rented a loft that we couldn't really afford and we were living in it as well. And so the simple fact was when that show came to an end, we needed another show to pay the rent to stay in the loft. And, you know, necessity was the mother of invention to some degree, right?
Mm-hmm. And I think whenever things get bad, because we still to this day, we're constantly like, oh my God, what's the next thing? We got, you know, you got to sort of feed it. You feed the machine. And, but for me personally, I just like, I'm a really good spinner. So like I can just spin. If I start to get a little dark,
right?
I can totally, Fenton will go half empty.
Oh.
I'm like almost always full.
Always empty. My back pocket is always empty.
I think to succeed in Hollywood, you need to be delusional.
Well,
and I think that
Randy ticks that box.
That's you know, you just have to convince yourself because it's hard. It's such an awful business, really. It really is.
I call it relentless optimism. Right. Yes. Like
Randy is relentlessly optimistic.
Yeah. It's like, no matter what you're like, I manage a team and I'm like the same way. It's like, oh, the client doesn't want to do X. I'm like, well, what if we did it this way? And then that doesn't work. What about this? I will not kill an idea until it is like out of blood and just skeletons on, you know, mm-hmm. That was a terrible metaphor. Sorry. I tried, but there's also like, I think that can create some delusion, as you mentioned. Mm-hmm. And I think you need that, the balance of what you bring to the table, Fenton, which is like
gloom, despair,
exactly.
Misery. It's right. Like that film Inside Out, right? I'm that sort of that blue haired person, yes, that's always weeping, uh-huh, with the cloud over their head.
So back to the question I was going to ask, with the show being called Innovation Crush, what is your current innovation crush? What are you crushing on that you see out in the
I'm
world?
I'm crushing on this show. I love that title, Innovation Crush.
Thank you.
It should be a
it's like a quadruple entendre.
What color is Innovation Crush?
Orange and black. See,
orange.
I'm pointing at my custom headphones. Thank you, Vmoda, for my custom headphones.
Orange is the World of Wonder colors are orange.
Yeah.
Well, is orange.
And I'm black. And this is a new relationship. Yeah. So orange
and black. Orange is black.
So aside from the show, like, is there anything out in the world, whether it's technology, culinary art, I don't know, a school you've heard of, something that you think is like, oh, wow, that is the future. That is an amazing development in our world. You're delivering just fine. Trust me. There's always like when I look at the sound waves of the show, it's like, it's always like it's quiet right here.
Really?
Wait, the next one is even harder though, just so you know.
The future is now. So there is so much stuff coming at you all at once. And I think people complain about information overload, but I think it's kind of a good thing. But a specific crush.
I might let you off. You guys might be the first people I ever let off the hook.
No, I want to nail it, right?
Because I'm thinking...
Your wheels are turning.
Yeah, and like I'm in the kitchen, like going through the house, in my car.
Is it your Nutribullet?
No.
Okay.
It's not the Nutribullet.
No, it's not. I love it, but...
I tried that Soylent product, you know, that I did.
Oh, did you?
That I do not have a crush on.
Yeah, so no.
It was disgusting.
Is that the new protein rage that everyone...
Yeah, it's like eating is the new...
What's it called?
It's called Soylent. It's like a powder.
Powder is like an astronaut drink. It's
absolutely disgusting. I'd sooner drink wheat paste or...
Well, you know, somebody tried to introduce me to one of the guys that started Soylent like a long time ago, and I was like, that sounds like an awful idea. But it was one of those things where it's like this person was a coder and sat for hours in front of a computer and really just, and it's like, I'm not interested in the eating experience, but I want to be able to fuel myself to do what I love most. And so like cooking became a disruption. And you go like,
so
what if I just had a powder that I could ingest? But I mean, food hacking in and of itself is a really, you know, amazing area where people are like finding or gastronomic chefs and like finding new ways to like reinvent the food and the eating experiences. So I'll answer that one for you guys. How about that?
Thank you.
Food hacking is your innovation crush.
Oh. Oh.
How did we discover that? And last but not least,
this is the really hard question.
It might be easy. I don't know. Like I thought that was, the last one was a layup. I thought, especially cause you guys,
what's your innovation crush?
That is a good question. I never have to think about it. I will say I'm kind of obsessed with, you know, the implications of biometric technology, like wearables and how they measure your heart rates and so on and so forth. And in your world, for the movie The Revenant, there's a company called Lightwave who worked with the filmmakers, and they put these wristbands on individuals during a screening. And they were able to measure like the tension in their body, their heart rates, their, you know, their movement, whether they laughed or didn't laugh, or body temperature. And so you think about how to make the next, you know, film and or market that film, you know, which ones are going to be the most emotionally impactful pieces to show. Cause you can look at the arc over the, I don't know how long the movie was, but over that amount of time and find out like collectively where the, you know, points of impact were. So that one came to mind for me.
You know, I'm just realizing there's an innovation crush that I'm about to have, but I don't have the information to share. So it's even worse than not having an answer. Rue told me about this machine that he's obsessed with. That you have to, there's a place on Wilshire on the west side where the old CW building used to be. When you go there and they wrap your legs and your lower legs, your upper legs and your butt. And it basically does this kind of vibration and you do it for like an hour and it's like exercising your heart. And he's done like 5 sessions of it. He's addicted to it. And it's so weird. We're having this conversation because this morning I thought, oh, he sent me a link and I meant to do the research and I would have remembered the name, but I don't know.
That's close enough. People can Google RuPaul and leg wrapping.
It's a heart massage though, right?
It's
a way to exercise when you don't feel like exercising.
Yes. And in particular, it's all about blood circulation and getting your heart, getting blood to places that blood just doesn't want to go on its own. I don't know.
Yeah, blood is so stubborn.
Yeah, that's stubborn blood.
Okay, last but not least, who wants to go first? I'm going to take a volunteer and then
I'll go first.
Yes, complete this phrase for me. Mm-mm. Innovation to me is...
new things.
So quick.
It's so bad, though.
You had that one in the back pocket.
Innovation is new things.
Randy,
innovation, you're the churner. Innovation is also overrated. Like, what's wrong with the old things? I mean, because when you were saying that, I was thinking about, I've suddenly gotten back into books. I am sick of waking up in the middle of the night and checking my iPhone for emails. It's sickness. And reading a book, which requires you to turn on a light and hold pages and do that old-fashioned thing, is actually really nice.
Yeah.
You know? Well, just throwing it out.
There's lines of thinking around the idea of touch and how we're losing our sense of tactile, you know, connection with things because you're tapping glass all day as opposed to like actually picking up and feeling what the texture of a book is like or, you know, the embossing of a cover and all these different things. So you're right. There is sort of a resurgence to, you know, more tactile physical experiences because like you can't stare at a screen at all hours of the day.
And you know, so much of our lives are virtual and digital. It's the screen age. Okay. We're living in the screen age, but that's why, you know, DragCon's coming up in a couple of weeks. And that's, it's like people
I'll be
really
there.
People really love like having that tactile experience of being there in person, right?
Well, you say that innovation is overrated, and I say that innovation is survival. So Fenton, be careful.
I love the fact that you guys are like polar opposites, damn near. But no, continue. What
that's
do you it.
Mean? That's all.
It's survival in what way, though? Like what?
Like innovate or die. Mm.
Oh, thanks, pal.
So, you know.
Or pick up a book. It's one or the other.
I read books too, but.
So, as we close, how can people find more Worlds of Wonders?
Worldofwonder.net, which is the WoW report edited by James St. James. And WoW Presents on YouTube.
What's a WoW report?
It's a blog.
Ah,
mm-hmm. It's a pop culture blog.
My research team wasn't. They
bit of a gap, huh? I'm so busy boogieing to the Pop Tarts this morning. You forgot to log on.
Yes, exactly.
Late breaking gossip, Hollywood gossip at the WoW Report.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, thank you both for joining us today. And this has been, I had a blast. I had fun. Just like you.
Really?
Yeah. No, really? I did. Does my face not show my enthusiasm?
No, I just thought we overstayed our welcome.
No,
I
thought we had 45 minutes. So I said, oh shit, I have to close.
I mean, we didn't bring any food. We didn't do nothing.
There's water. There's
we
water
should have brought like a coffee cake, you know, for the table or something like that. You
should have taken me in a limousine and like driven me around town. But thank you for joining us, everyone. This has been another installment of Innovation Crush, and we will talk to you next time.